Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
So good to be with you, exploring the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Remind those of you listening on radio, you can also hear us commercial-free online and webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz. We've got a fun show today. We're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And our first guest I'm going to introduce you to in just a little bit is William Huba. He's the founder of Hyvari. They're a startup focused on using machine learning to automate server monitoring and alerting. Bill Hubert believes that we're headed for a world loaded with sensors. We've already got sensors everywhere, and he thinks it's going to be extremely prevalent, and that is his prediction. He's going to be presenting at the Homeland Security Technologies Conference going on November 12th through the 14th in Boston. And you can learn more about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link to the conference. Also at that conference is Aman Kumar. He's going to come on the second half of the program with Hassan Alam. So, but right now, let's get right to our guest. What do you say?
Stand by.
Well, right now we've got a real fun guy I want to introduce you to. He's William Huba. He's the founder of Hyvari, a startup focused on using machine learning with the whole monitoring and alerting in the server industry, and I know nothing about it, so he's gonna fill us in. William is making a presentation at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference in the middle of November, and so we've been real lucky to track him down in Mountain View, California, at his office. Welcome to the program, William.
Thanks, Colonel.
Now, Hyvari is a startup. I mean, you just started this for this tool that you've developed, and using machine learning to automate server monitoring and alerting, and server monitoring and alerting. This is what is this all the storage that's on the servers that we need to somehow sift through in order to get to the real things that we want stored? Is that where I'm going with this?
That's correct. We're starting off looking mostly at resource usage, looking for anything that's anomalous, being able to pick that out so we can fire off alerts and the admins know about it. A lot can be expanded from that, though. We want to look at things like log files, be able to kind of take more of a security approach and say, you know, something is really weird here, and we can figure that out by using machine learning to determine what the normal usage looks like.
Okay, so that's the crux of it. Now, let's get into this just a little bit. It's unique, it's durable, and there's different tracking methods. Tell us from a user standpoint. Let's say that I'm the guy that's got to use it. What can I expect it to do for me?
You could expect to not have to constantly tune what you would use otherwise. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to have some kind of monitoring solution, and most of the ones out there now require a large amount of tuning, which means you already have to know your environment very well. When you start taking machine learning and putting that into it, it lets you get rid of that first step and be able to just kind of automatically configure exactly what's going on. It also lets you dynamically adjust things as the environment changes later. So from the user's perspective, you get a lot of ease of use, and you get a lot more accuracy than you would doing things manually.
Okay, now tuning. When I think of tuning, I think of the old days when we used to tune a radio or a television set or something like that. You're talking about tuning a server. Now, that's got to be some sort of different application or something that I'm not quite grasping. Take me there.
Sure. It's actually a very similar concept. If you're looking at a particular setting, it may be correct right now, and then the next day or the next week, it's no longer the most accurate setting, so you need to kind of adjust it. So it's exactly in line with tuning your radio. Maybe it sounds perfect one day, and then you start getting a little static, and you need to adjust it a little bit to find that right channel again.
All right, so then, and what your machine does is kind of locks it in like we have right now with modern radios, where we don't have to tune them. They're just kind of locked into a channel, and they kind of stick with the channel. I mean, you're too young to remember this, but we had automatic frequency control. We thought that was a great deal when it came in for FM radios, because they were always being detuned. But is that what you're doing with your equipment?
Yeah, that's a great analogy. The only difference is, instead of looking for a particular radio channel and finding what's strongest, we're looking for any given set of data and finding what the normal actually looks like for that, and just kind of constantly adjusting it to whatever the current normal is.
All right, so you would feed into this equipment the kind of data that you're looking for. Now, it could be telephone numbers. It could be email addresses. It could be DNA. It could be any number of different things. And your equipment then will tune in to search through all the things that are saved on that server, so that it all has it categorized in one place. Is that how that works?
That's right. From the security's perspective, we'd be looking at things like user logins. We can kind of figure out what users are normally logging in at a given time. And that may change the following month or the following week or something. So that's where the tuning aspect comes in, and we can kind of adjust when that user normally logs in, what our view of that is. So then if there's something that's really odd, say a user that never logs in on a Sunday is suddenly in there constantly on the weekend, we can kind of say, hey, this doesn't look right. You might want to make sure this is legitimate and not an attacker going after you.
Oh, I see. So this is really good as far as cybersecurity goes, and for defense. And I can see where it would be very useful in industry and that sort of thing. How long have you had this tool in development?
We've been in development for about 6 or 7 months.
Okay. And then you're going to be marketing this, and if you've got the final piece at the end of September, you're going to kind of be talking about it at the conference and let people know that you have it, so you could supply the companies that want it. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah. So the conference is in November, so by that time we should be well into our beta and have a pretty solid product to show off.
Well, that would be terrific. Now, you were talking about uniqueness and durability of different tracking methods. Did you want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So the paper that I'm presenting at the conference is along the same vein of what we're doing at Hivory, but it's looking at just the web application level. So as a user, somebody that has a web application, security is going to be a big concern, but it's not always easy to figure out how somebody is getting back. You know, I may want to ban somebody once I know they're attacking me, but it's very hard to ban a person. You can ban an IP address, you can look at different properties and try to ban that element, but to actually identify a person and say, you know, I don't want you here anymore, or maybe I want to give you a worse class of service because I don't trust you, that's much more difficult. So that's where tracking comes in from a defensive perspective. If you can accurately track somebody, you can give them different tiers of service. You can actually ban them as a person rather than trying to ban some property of them. Traditionally, client-side storage is the way you would track somebody, meaning the server sends an HTTP cookie to the agent, to the browser, and the browser will then send that cookie back when it's making requests to the server. So if the user is not malicious, you have a way of tracking them that way. You can say, I've set this cookie, you're giving me this cookie back, you're that person.
Okay.
That kind of falls apart when you're talking about malicious users, though.
Mm-hmm.
They can change those cookies before they send it to you. They can choose not to take it at all. There's lots of ways to get around that. So that's what we're kind of doing by looking at the uniqueness and durability of the different tracking methods, is we're saying, how durable is this? Is this method something that can stand up to a malicious user actively trying to get around being tracked? Is it something that can go across different properties? If I'm in Chrome and I want to switch over to Internet Explorer, will that method still work? Mm-hmm. Or have I now lost all that data?
Yeah.
Uniqueness kind of identifies how sure I can be that I'm looking at the person I think I am. If I'm looking at certain properties, I may not be certain. I may be able to narrow it down and say, this is one of 10 people. Or I may be able to say, I know that this is this exact person. There's no one else could possibly be. So we've looked at a few different areas for where this can be applied. The client-side storage is what I just mentioned as far as cookies, but we've also expanded that to look at a few different other methods. There's HTML5 local storage, which is a fairly new way of storing data on a client. It's supported in all the major browsers. It's a little bit more durable than cookies because it's harder for a client to, say, ignore it or to modify it dynamically unless they know it's there. It's a little bit less visible to the user. And the uniqueness is fully unique. Somebody can still modify it if they know it's there, mm-hmm. but if you do get a valid value back for that, you know that that's the value that you set. There's also Flash storage objects in Adobe Flash, and those have actually come under a lot of media attention recently. There were a few companies that got in a little bit of trouble for using Flash storage for exactly this reason, for tracking users.
Really?
The benefit of that is that it's very, very durable. You have guaranteed uniqueness. The storage objects are actually one of the only local storage methods that can go across browsers. So if somebody's tracking you with a storage object, then you try to switch browsers, you're on the same system, that object is still accessible to them when you go back to their page. And the last method that we looked at for client storage is using cached content. So normally when you load a website, that a lot of that information will get cached by your browser so that it doesn't have to re-download it every time you go to that site. Because the caching is controlled by the server to a large extent, you can send some metadata along with that. And one way of doing metadata is an e-tag, which is essentially a signature that says you have this particular version of this this asset that you downloaded. The client will save that and send it back up. The next time it tries to load that page, it'll say, hey, I have this version. Is this the newest version? But since that kind of signature is completely arbitrary, the server can send whatever it wants in there. It can send a unique ID, and the client will then send that unique ID back. So the server now knows, okay, this is the ID I set before. It must be this person. I can positively identify them. So that's all of the client-side storage methods that we looked at, and they all have roughly similar properties. There's pretty much a guarantee of uniqueness in them. The durability varies a little bit, but with the exception of the Flash long-term storage objects, they're all fairly easy to delete by a client. So that's when we started looking at some different methods of identifying users. IP address is normally a pretty standard way of identifying people.
Yeah.
The problem with IP addresses is they can change,
okay.
And in some cases they can be spoofed.
Oh.
And since it's so easy to change an IP address, we don't want to just focus on that and be able to say, this IP address correlates to this person, because the next day it might not.
Mm-hmm.
So instead what we did is we said, what are some other properties of IP addresses we can use to identify somebody without actually just looking at the IP address? And what we came up with is geolocation and DNS. For geolocation, we take the IP address of the user and we figure out approximately where they are. This can vary in accuracy. We may be able to get it within a few blocks, or it may be within a few miles. Once we have that approximate location, even if the user changes their IP address, it's still likely to be within a certain radius of what we had before. So instead of just saying, this IP address is correlated to this user, we can instead say, this user is in this area. And when they get a new IP address that's also in that area, we can connect those two together and say, okay, this might be the same user. For DNS, it's something similar. We have a neat little trick that causes the user to send a DNS request to us using
okay.
a particular identification string that we've set for them.
Oh.
So we can then get the IP address of their DNS server, which is much less likely to change than the user's actual IP address.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, of course, is that we lose a lot of the uniqueness that way. In both of those cases, there's very little guarantee that we'll get the exact user we want.
Oh, really?
But it's still useful since we can narrow down who we're looking at. The final set of methods that we looked at is fingerprinting techniques.
Really?
So this is named exactly after a human fingerprint.
Sure.
The idea is that you're taking a bunch of different parameters. You're looking at them together to decide what something is. In our case, we looked at a few different things. One thing we looked at is the TCP IP stack of the underlying operating system.
Okay.
It turns out that each operating system kind of has its own stack mm-hmm. that behaves in different ways.
Really? Okay.
So by looking at certain properties that are being set on the network, you can determine whether somebody is running Windows or OS X or different variants of Linux.
Okay, yeah.
That's, again, not very, very unique, but it is pretty reliable. It's somewhat difficult to change on most operating systems, and it's also something that very few people ever think to change or would want to change. So even though you're only saying this is running Windows, or maybe you can say it's running Windows XP, and you can't narrow it down too much more beyond that, it still gives you another parameter that you can narrow down the users that you're looking at to try to identify a specific person.
All right. Well, then, are these methods aggregated together into a single metric? Is that where you're going with this?
That's exactly right. So all of these methods individually have been looked at before for tracking. What we did that's kind of unique is we took all of them, assigned different values to them based on how unique and how durable those methods are, aggregated them together to say exactly what value we want to assign this person or this session. And we have a threshold, and we say if it's above that value, then we can positively say it matches some profile that we're trying to track. If it's below that value, we don't have enough information to say either way.
Okay, and are there more results of this aggregation algorithm that we need to discuss? Can you fill us in any deeper on this?
Sure. So when we looked at it as an aggregate, what we found is that we could effectively track people after clearing everything in the browser, clearing out all of the data they would normally get rid of to try to get rid of anything that's tracking them.
Mm-hmm.
We could somewhat effectively track them across different browsers on the same computer.
Okay.
It was a little bit more hit or miss. We weren't quite as certain about what profile we were looking at. And we were very effectively able to track them going from private browsing mode in a browser. So when you start taking all of this together, the things that a user would normally do to try to evade tracking no longer work, because there's enough data coming from enough different places
mm-hmm.
that when looked at together, we can determine exactly who they are.
Okay. All right. That helps. That helps a lot. Planned future work with the addition of machine learning. You got some things in the works there. You're going to be bringing forward here that you can tip us off to.
Yep. So far, essentially, what we have is just a proof of concept. What we plan to do going forward is collect a very large amount of data and use some machine learning techniques to look at different variables coming in, basically all the different fingerprinting methods that we've been tracking, and figure out exactly how unique each of those are. Because right now, we can kind of only guess it. We can say, like, we know about 50% of the world is running Internet Explorer, for example. So that's not that unique of a thing. But when we look at a given environment, that may not be the case. We may be in a network where everybody is running Internet Explorer. So once we can kind of apply some machine learning to that data, we can adjust what values we're assigning different methods dynamically and adjust what our actual threshold is for a unique profile. And that'll let us get a lot more accurate and be able to adjust different environments dynamically.
Wow, you're doing your part for us in cybersecurity that we talk about in this program a lot, because that's a big deal, and it's getting bigger, and we're all wondering what's going to happen. A couple of years ago, there were people calling for scrapping the internet altogether and starting over from scratch with private industry and getting government out of it. And more and more, we're running into people like you that are saying, no, there's things we can do to constantly be one up in the war in cyber warfare. So you're the type of person who believes that we can make it right, make it secure as we move forward, right?
That's right. I don't think it's a lost battle yet. There's still a lot of techniques we can take from other areas of the industry, applying to security, and get something really great to combat attackers.
You get your start, I understand, some years back, working on covert channel communications and mobile ad hoc network protocols for UAVs. How did you get involved with developing those protocols for the UAVs?
So it was actually a research project at my college, funded by the Air Force and the Navy Research Lab. So I got involved with that as a summer co-op. And ended up working there for about another year and a half after that co-op. We were working on some interesting problems, more in the networking space rather than the security space. But as far as handling communications at very high speeds for networks just dynamically created and dynamically destroyed, being able to route across a large number of hops with these things that are moving at 600 kilometers through the air.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I could well understand that. Well, tell me, William, you're an expert in all this stuff, and I'm kind of a neophyte here and trying to grasp the things that you're talking about, and it all makes a lot of sense. But obviously, there's something that I maybe didn't delve into. What sort of takeaway do you want to give us here? What have we missed?
I think the really key takeaway here is nothing that we're doing right now, looked at individually, is something new. But to solve the problems that are currently out there in the security space, we have to start looking at things in a different way. And what I mean by that is all of these tracking methods are individually defeatable. They've been looked at before. But when you start looking at them as an aggregate and you start trying to take data from different sources and kind of put it together into one place, you get something really new and unique that can drastically change the security world.
Okay, now how about put on the meditation cap for just a minute and close your eyes and give us a peek 5 or 10 years, 20 years maybe so down the road. What do you see? What do you see coming at us in the future?
I think one of the biggest things we'll see is a massive increase in sensor networks. So right now, a lot of things that we want to monitor in the world, whether it's weather, traffic, forest fires, water levels, etc., they tend to be centralized. You have some massive sensors, or you have a very small cluster of sensors looking at that thing and figuring out what's going on. But right now, we have everybody running around with smartphones. Those smartphones are covered in sensors. We have houses starting to get sensors, et cetera. So I think in the future, all of that will start getting aggregated in a giant sensor network that will be able to kind of do distributed data, figure out a lot more accurately and a lot more cheaply exactly how things are changing in our world.
Oh, wow. What a picture that is. All right. Some life lesson.
Hope is not a strategy.
Hope is not a strategy, you say. All right. Well, I love it. That's really good. Okay. Well, William Huber, the founder of Hivery, if I'm pronouncing it right. Hivery. There we go. I got it right. We're going to see you at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference, going to go on in mid-November. So good of you to be with us today. I really do appreciate it very much, taking the time to explain this to us and make it clear. And I love the advances that you're working on. You've been just a fascinating guest. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Colonel.
Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Whom in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Mother Teresa, the good you do today, people may forget tomorrow. Do good anyway. Give the world the best you have, and it may never be enough. Give your best anyway. In the end, it's between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway.